from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. This week, the U.S. and Europe announced new sanctions against Russia, aimed straight at Russia's number one source of wealth, oil and gas. There's talk of broken treaties, of the U.S. helping Ukraine's military target Russian weapons. Vladimir Putin seems to welcome conflict. This hour, On Point, Russia, the U.S., and where this goes. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Are we tumbling into a new Cold War? How should the U.S. handle Russia? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. We will hear in a moment from Ambassador Michael McFaul, Washington's outspoken envoy to Moscow until earlier this year. Joining me first from New York is Masha Gessen, Russian-American journalist, author of The Man Without a Face, The Unlikely Rise of Vladimir Putin. She's just been in Russia, returned yesterday. Masha Gessen, welcome back to On Point. It's great to have you here.
Thank you. Great to be here.
What do you see going on in this relationship between Russia and, I guess it's fair once again to say, the West?
Absolutely. And I'm glad you put it that way. I actually don't think the question, you know, are we headed toward a new Cold War is particularly useful.
Okay.
Because it, I think it sort of shifts the frame. I mean, the comparison to the Cold War is not terribly informative. The Cold War was a standoff in which each side was basically trying to protect its own influence over its own territory.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a Cold War. I mean, there was no active warfare most of the time for the decades that the standoff continued.
Plenty of proxy war, but yes, okay.
Right. But that's not what we're seeing now. What we're seeing now is, first of all, confrontation, not a standoff. Russia is very openly seeking confrontation with the West and with the United States in particular. And there's active warfare. And while from
you're talking
here,
about in Ukraine.
States, right. Mm-hmm. From the States, it may look like Russia is fighting Ukraine. Russia, however, is very much framing it as waging war against the West and against the United States in Ukraine.
You're just back from Russia.
I am.
How
I flew
do,
in yesterday.
What's the mood there? Here we're looking at the Malaysian airliner that's come down, all those deaths, a terrible tragedy, absolutely shocking. It seems to lie right on Moscow's doorstep as it gave rockets to those in eastern Ukraine who apparently brought it down. How are Russians seeing what's going on?
Well, Russia is very much a country at war, and one of the hallmarks of a country at war is extreme polarization. Basically, everybody feels under siege. The vast majority of the population feels that Russia is under siege. Russia is protecting itself against this huge conglomeration of enemies, and that's why it's fighting in Ukraine. And you have to be patriotic, and you have to be constantly mobilized, and you have to be on the lookout for enemies and for spies in your own crowd. And you have to demonstrate your patriotism either by wearing something or saying something at all times that marks you as a patriot. And the very tiny minority of intellectuals who are opposed to the war also feels under siege because it is indeed surrounded by people who are extremely hostile toward this tiny minority.
The sanctions this week, Europe and the U.S. have come out in the wake of the Malaysia Airlines downing with what are said to be much tougher sanctions. What about the sanctions, their potential bite, how they're perceived in Russia?
Well, I was leaving the country just as the sanctions mm-hmm. were coming in. It's a very strange feeling because it feels like the entire country is in denial about the impact that this will have on the Russian economy. Some people are in denial because they don't want to face the fact that their wealth is about to evaporate. Some people are in denial because they're invested professionally in not letting other people understand just how dire the state of the Russian economy is. But it is dire, and the sanctions are likely to have a significant impact on an economy that is already very nearly in shambles. But at the same time, the sanctions are much harsher than anything that's been done before. They certainly represent a major step for Europe, which for the last 4 months couldn't find a united way of dealing with Russia. But I still think that they're based on a fallacy. And the fallacy is that sanctions can force Putin to do something, to perhaps withdraw from Ukraine, to change his stand. That's not going to happen. And what's usually said is that, okay, if that doesn't happen, then perhaps sanctions will motivate the elites to coalesce against Putin, which I think is probably a much more realistic prospect. But then sanctions should not be created in this step-by-step manner. They should not be a sort of, we're going to do this now, and if you don't listen to us, we're going to do something even worse weeks or months down the road. If the goal of the sanctions is to get the elites to act against Putin, then the sanctions should be harsh and they should be instant.
The language is going to some pretty wild places in a hurry here. This is yesterday in the Washington Post. Their editorial saying they have to be prepared, the West, for a wounded Putin to become more aggressive. And quoting from the Post here, the Washington Post, the West also should not shrink from the destabilization of Mr. Putin's regime. I mean, we're into the big time here. And you say the sanctions may not be enough, but I mean, they go at Russian banking in a very big way. They go at the defense industries, if that's what we're talking about here, military. They go at technology Russia needs to tap new Arctic deep sea and shale oil reserves. Well, the West has this technology, Russia doesn't. Without it, the gravy train cannot go on indefinitely. They look pretty serious, Masha.
They do, although, you know, the gravy train has been stalled for quite a long time, and that's part of the reason behind this this new aggressive Russia. I mean, the only way that Putin can hold on to power is to be an effective mobilizer, to be a president of a country at war. He can no longer rely on economic prosperity. This was true before the war in Ukraine started.
What, the oil bandwagon, the oil flow is already down, gas flow? It doesn't look like it when you see the charts of how much they sell to Europe and beyond.
Well, Russia, the way that the Russian economy was constructed, and corruption is a major component of this, probably the main factor in shaping the economy, is that it needed oil prices to be constantly climbing in order to maintain the kind of prosperity that had maintained Putin's balance and Putin's hold on power. That had stopped being the case last year. I mean, the Russian economy had pretty much stalled.
You say Russia is at war. If Putin has, are you saying he's led his country to war? And if so, with what? Are we just talking about a war with Kiev, with this little, I mean, important, but, former Soviet Union member on his southwest border?
No, Russia and Putin in particular absolutely does not view this as a war with Ukraine. And this is, I think, if we understand one thing about this war, we have to understand this. Russia is waging war against Western civilization itself. Now, this is not, you know, some sort of paranoid American right-winger speaking here. I'm quoting the main Kremlin ideologues. What they're basically saying is that there are two civilizations in the world. The Western civilization, with its crazy idea of universal human rights, these are all quotes, wants to impose its standards on the rest of the world. And only Russia is in a position and has the courage of its convictions to stand up for a traditional civilization. So Russia is waging war against Western civilization, and this is very well articulated in Russia itself. And Ukraine is just a stand-in. It's a symbol of Western civilization. To Russians, Ukraine's sort of modest steps toward affiliating with the West increasingly was symbolic of the expansion of the West and the expansion of Western values.
Masha Gessen, author of The Man Without a Face, just back this week from Russia. Please stand by there in New York with us right now from Stanford, California, Michael McFaul. He was U.S. ambassador to Russia from 2012 until February this year, former senior director for Russian and Eurasian affairs at the National Security Council in the Obama White House, now professor of political science at Stanford. Michael McFaul, Ambassador McFaul, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks for having me.
What do you make of the way Masha is reading what she's seeing in Russia? Russia at war with Western civilization, sanctions, even stiff ones, not enough, needs to be tougher, not Cold War. It sounds like something hotter, at least from the Russian side, that Masha's describing.
I agree with everything Masha just said. Point
blank. Wow. Okay, we can stop here.
Yeah, let's just stop. But let me say something in addition. So without question, I think what she underscored, if anybody of our listeners takes one thing away from our conversation, is to understand that this is being framed as a war against the West. You know, Kiev is a proxy. Kiev is the first line of that battle. But if you watch Russian television, listen to what Russian leaders say, follow my Twitter feed. It's there every single day. That's the way it's being framed. Now, a couple of things I would add. It didn't start with Ukraine. I think that's very important for people to understand. It started when Putin decided to come back to power back in September of 2011 and switched jobs with then-President Medvedev, who's now the prime minister. In December of that year, there were parliamentary elections, and they were falsified, just like a lot of other Russian elections, by the way, before then. But different from earlier elections, the falsification and irregularities were exposed, and tens of thousands of Russians came out on the street to protest that. And that made Putin very nervous, in my opinion, very nervous about his legitimacy and his story for why he's president. Earlier, when he was president for the first 8 years, he had a story. I think it was a wrong story. It was I've written about it, why I thought it was incorrect. But for most Russians, it was he restored the state and grew the economy. That was not good enough for those protesters on the street, and that began a period where he had to have an enemy to maintain his legitimacy at home.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the U.S., Russia, Ukraine, Putin, and talk of a new Cold War, hot war, conflict. Masha Gessen is with us, Russian-American journalist, just back from Russia yesterday. Her book out last year, The Man Without a Face, The Unlikely Rise of Vladimir Putin, joins us from New York. Michael McFaul, Ambassador Michael McFaul, is with us. He was Washington's top envoy, ambassador to Russia, until just earlier this year, now at Stanford. U.S. and European sanctions really ratcheted up this week. Here's President Obama on Tuesday talking about those sanctions, how they would hurt the Russian economy.
Because we're closely coordinating our actions with Europe, the sanctions we're announcing today will have an even bigger bite. Now, Russia's actions in Ukraine and the sanctions that we've already imposed have made a weak Russian economy even weaker. Foreign investors already are increasingly staying away. Even before our actions today, nearly $100 billion in capital was expected to flee Russia.
And the president said, we'll talk about this, but the president of the United States said it doesn't have to be this way.
Russia is once again isolating itself from the international community, setting back decades of genuine progress. And it doesn't have to come to this. It didn't have to come to this. It does not have to be this way. This is a choice that Russia, and President Putin in particular, has made.
Ambassador McFaul, Masha Gessen, there's a lot to talk about here. Our listeners want in on it. John in Ann Arbor, Michigan. John, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom. I appreciate you taking my comment. As a Russian Soviet specialist, I'm very troubled by the widely rampant America-phobic response in Russia and the widely rampant Russophobic response in the U.S. to relations between our two countries. There are a number of issues here on which I have tried unsuccessfully to engage Michael McFaul and others on over the years. And we've really got to look at it. Quite frankly, from the comments I've seen, I feel that your comments on your two guests are rather skewed and are not really discussing.
Well, help us here, John, because I don't have the feeling that there are many Americans who are really hankering to get back into it with Russia. We did that for decades. It was no fun. It was very costly. It had all kinds of downside, though people were happy with the way it turned out with the Berlin Wall coming down. But do you really think, John, that Americans want to resume some kind of big global standoff with Russia?
No, but I think vis-a-vis Russia and her history, I think there is a lot of discomfort in this country, and I think that that does inform how we respond to it, and attempts on parts of people like myself to try to correct some of these things just don't get anywhere.
I mean, you've got an authoritarian leader, you've got what appears to be a corrupt government, and you've got Russia quite obviously militarily, barely through surrogates, I mean, almost directly in Ukraine. Don't those things amount to a problem? Put on top of that what Masha Gessen says about Putin and Moore saying war with the West.
They are a problem, but I think that there's also problems in terms of the coup that occurred in February in Kyiv. And as I posted on your website, I can't see how a responsible Russian leader wouldn't respond to the situation there, similarly to what Putin has. I do not like Putin, and I don't like what he's done in Syria. But having said that, there are some aspects of this that we've ignored, both to the detriment of Russia, Ukraine, and ourselves, and future relations. And that's troubling. And you'll find on your website, I've set out some of my feelings on this.
John, we'll look at those, and I appreciate your call from Ann Arbor. Here's Vladimir Putin. This was last week, talking about the armed conflict in eastern Ukraine and saying, we're ready to move past military conflict. Here's Putin.
For its part, Russia will do all that it can to make the conflict in eastern Ukraine move from today's military phase into the phase of negotiations, into the phase exclusively peaceful and diplomatic.
Russian President Vladimir Putin, interpreted there by Euronews. Michael McFaul, you hear our caller's concern. We're too ready to go Russophobic. We don't have to. And others are writing this to us as well. Come on, Ukraine is right up there, nestled against Russia. Every country of that size has a sphere of influence. Why are we, you know, getting so deeply involved right on Russia's border? How would we feel if it was Mexico in that vein?
So two comments. First of all, I personally am not Russophobic. I've lived in Russia since 1983, off and on. Some of my best friends in life are Russians. I love Russian culture, Russian history, and so does the president, by the way, a gentleman I worked for 7 years, actually 2 years before he became president. And because of
President
that,
Obama, you're talking
President
about.
Obama, not President Putin. Mm-hmm. And because of that, we started a policy called the Reset, designed to try to find win-win outcomes for the United States and for Russia at the beginning of our administration. And we achieved a lot. We got a lot of things done. And just 3 years ago, three short years ago, 65% of Russians had a positive image of the United States, and nearly the same number had a positive approval of President Obama. At the time, by the way, his approval rating in Russia was higher than it was in the United States. We used to joke about that. So something happened that changed that, not just, you know, Cold War mentalities or Russophobic ideas in the United States. Something changed. And let me give you one other case. It sounds like people are coming in saying, well, what about it's right on Russia's borders?
Yeah.
Do you remember the last revolution, coup, regime change that happened in Russia's territory? Let me tell you about it. 100 people died. 300,000 citizens left. And that country felt like it was on the verge of civil war. This is just 3 years ago. Do you remember it?
You're talking Georgia?
No. And the fact that you don't even know, one of the most educated journalists in our country, is a good sign. Kyrgyzstan. And the reason you don't know, Tom, and I'll bet you most people didn't know, is because back then, when that crisis happened, I was working at the White House at the time, President Obama and President Medvedev worked together to diffuse the tensions around that, to try to make sure that it did not escalate, because at that time we had a relationship with the government of Russia where we were seeking win-win outcomes. And by the way, that particular coup, revolution, I'll leave it to others to describe what it was vital to American national interests, because then we had something called the Manaz Transit Center that was very important to our war efforts in Afghanistan. Likewise, Russia had a military base there, and it was very important to them. So I just tell you that story as an instance of, to echo what the president said in that clip you just said, it didn't have to be this way. This is not the result of some long trajectory of great power rivalry or Russian and American culture. This is the result, in my opinion, of some very specific decisions that Putin has made himself, not the result of these bigger structural factors.
Trying to figure out the framework here. It's unnerving. George in Stamford, Connecticut. George, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi. You're not saying anything about the riches, like the rich people fighting over the riches of the Ukrainian area now. You're saying it has nothing to do with that. That, you know, the president goes after the oligarchy by tying up their money. In other words, the rich over in Russia trying to take over Ukraine again, and R is trying to make all sorts of gas deals and whatever else they got to sell over there. You're telling me that that's not what this is really about? You're trying to say that it's about some other mythical creature that Putin's a bad guy all of a sudden, and all our good guys are out for the Ukrainian people?
George, let us pick it up. Masha Gessen, what was it we heard? Joe Biden's son, if I have this correct, on the board of a Ukrainian energy company. Our caller George says it's just our oligarchs going after the wealth of Ukraine versus theirs.
Well, first of all, I don't think that there's that much wealth to be fought over there. Second of all, let's look at what Russia has done, right? And that, this gets in part to the previous caller's point. Russia has carried out the first forcible annexation of land in Europe since World War II. This is not a skirmish on the Russian border. This is a serious threat to peace in Europe as it has been established for the last 70 years, right? So that's one point. The other point is by annexing Crimea, Russia has taken on huge financial liabilities, and it is not at all clear that it has gained anything in terms of wealth. The same certainly goes for eastern Ukraine. This is not primarily, I mean, I'm not saying that there are not individuals there who have their own stakes and their own financial interests, but this is not what it is primarily about.
Breaking world order, and where does that go? Paul in Columbia, South Carolina. Paul, you're on the air.
Hey, thanks. Great show. What I would point out is a couple things. One is that it seems to me that Putin sees himself as a great Russian leader, and he has ambitions to establish his reputation historically in that sense. And I think it's more in the nature of, I'm going to reestablish that I will not be forgiven in future generations if I allow Ukraine to go. If I allow parts of the country to split up, then I'm worse than the Soviets were. And I think that he doesn't care about all the short-term problems. But I will say that it is a part of his program, I think, to also elevate himself, and that fomenting these crises and such solidifies his power. And I think it's more about Putin and more about establishing a historical record for himself, and also to show that Russia is not part of the West. It's not a war on the West. It's so much as it is a, we're not a part of the West. We're great in our own right apart from the West. And we can be, again, not maybe a Cold War, but we can be a pole. We can be one of the polar powers.
Yeah, Paul, I appreciate your call. Let me take it to Ambassador McFaul. Is this, for whatever reasons, Putin's reputation, his legacy, Russian destiny, is this about putting the Soviet Union back together because something in the Russian DNA requires it, Michael McFaul?
So it's not about putting the Soviet Union back together per se, but I think Paul is on to a key piece of what motivates Putin from my observations of him both in the government and before, which is he most definitely thinks of himself as a historical leader. Peter the Great, Catherine the Great, he wants to be thought of in those terms. But his strategy for it has changed. And let me just talk about a little bit before this crisis started. Mm-hmm. If you were to have interviewed me in the beginning of February when I was still ambassador in Moscow and asked me what's Putin's chief foreign policy objective, I would have said it's the creation of the Eurasian Economic Union.
An answer to the EU.
Correct. And that is to bring back the former countries of the Soviet Union into this economic union as a counter to the West. So very much along the lines that Paul just described. Second, and Masha talked about this earlier, Putin wanted to establish himself as the anti-West, the anti-Americans, in two regards. One is this conservative leader against the decadent liberal West, but the other was as the anti-imperial response to the so-called American interventionist, this weird confab of the left and the right that he was appealing to internationally.
And that latter meaning what? The potential expansion of NATO up to
Russia? No. Intervening in Syria, intervening in
globally.
Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
We are the folks that preserve sovereignty. Mm. Let's look at how he's done with those goals. So what happened in February, when the government collapsed in Kiev, he decided to go into Crimea. that ensured that the Eurasian Economic Union was no more. And so when Paul
said, why would that be?
Then he went into Crimea and Ukraine, you know, I think forevermore he left he more than any other Ukrainian leader, by the way, Putin helped to consolidate and solidify a Ukrainian national identity today that now looks to the West for security and prosperity, not to the East. So he picked up Crimea, but he lost Ukraine. And to Paul's point, that's exactly right. I think he will be remembered for that. That's a setback. That is not, in my view, achieving the goals that he originally had. And to the second point about wanting Russia to be a Pole, absolutely right. I think that's right. But look at how his actions in Crimea and now in eastern Ukraine have weakened that. I think pretty hard to say, oh, I'm the anti-interventionist these days. I'm for sovereignty. That doesn't resonate, I think, in the world, not just America. Mm. And I just say that it just seems like Putin has lost the ability to have his strategies meet the objectives that he originally had.
If you want to hear a little bit of that, listen right here. This was Saturday, Ukrainian President Poroshenko giving a speech to the Ukrainian military, interpreted by Reuters here.
It is not an internal conflict. It is Ukraine defending its territory from foreign mercenaries, bandits, and terrorists. Today we showed that Ukraine possesses weaponry to defend the country.
Sounds hot. Chris, in Corpus Christi, Texas. Chris, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I had a question that some of the polling data that at least I've seen, and I think many of us have seen, is that in Russia, Putin's approval rating is really high. And I was curious, are those numbers believable? And if so, why has his actions in Ukraine made him so popular amongst Russians?
Marcia Gessen, you're just back for Chris in Corpus Christi, Texas. What do you say?
Well, a couple of things. First of all, opinion polling in authoritarian countries is notoriously unreliable, not in the sense that it doesn't take the temperature of opinion as it stands at the moment that the poll is taken. It most certainly does. It's just that public opinion in an authoritarian state is extremely fickle.
But isn't he popular? Isn't Chris right in that general characterization, popular?
He is extremely popular.
So?
But that popularity is eminently changeable because we're looking at an authoritarian state. And because in an authoritarian state, it's a matter of survival to be able to change your opinion on a dime to go with the dominant ideology.
But why? But right now, Chris is asking, why is he so popular if this is so problematic, what he's leading?
I'm getting there. Actually, I don't think there's any huge mystery or surprise there. I mean, generally speaking, presidents in time of war become extremely popular. If the war drags on, if it turns out to be unsuccessful, then the popularity begins to suffer. But at the beginning of a military campaign, every state leader in the world always experiences a rise in his popularity. Now, why is this rise so noticeable? Why is it so huge? Because it's an authoritarian state. Because it's a state in which the government has controlled all broadcast television for the last 13 years. That's half a generation. That's like being able to beam their message of military aggression into the brains of 98% of the households 24/7, which is exactly what's happening.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this about the U.S., Russia, Ukraine, Putin, the talk of a new Cold War conflict here, whether this has to be. What's going on? My guests are U.S. Ambassador to Russia until earlier this year, Michael McFaul. He joins us today from Stanford, California. He's at Stanford now. Marcia Gessen is here, Russian-American journalist, author of The Man Without a Face, The Unlikely Rise of Vladimir Putin, joins us from New York. She is just back from Russia. Lots of response online of all kinds. Lots of skepticism here. Edward says, we are being manipulated. Run up gas prices, expand government. This is business as usual. CJ says, this is 1980s speech. Please stop. And he's kind of addressing you there, Michael, but maybe both of my guests today. Let me get one more. Jim in Canton, Ohio. Jim, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Yes, I disagree. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I disagree with both of your guests today. I think they're both wrong about Putin's motives and the reasons for his popularity. On the most important lesson of history to the Russian people, and to the eastern Ukrainians as well, is World War II. Hitler got closer and closer to the Soviet border before he launched Operation Barbarossa. And I think what they see our policy as being is a Barbarossa too. We're getting closer.
I mean, Western encroachment on their frontier.
Yeah, on their territory, and with the end, the ultimate end being world domination. And they're the last big country that we have to take out to rule the world. And they see us as being very militaristic, which we are. We're always starting wars every year or two. You know, there's another war going that we start. And I think they see us as a very dangerous enemy who's getting in on their territory, taking over the Baltic states, taking over Central Asia, the Caucasus, and we're getting closer and closer so we can start another war, World War III. That's what they're worried about. And Putin's got the guts to stand up to that.
I don't know who has an interest in World War III, but Masha, what about it? This is about Russia looking around and feeling encircled and putting its dukes up.
That's true. I mean, that is a very accurate portrayal of the way that the Kremlin and the television viewing Russian public views the world. I don't happen to think it's accurate. I also don't think it's good for the Russian people. It's obviously disastrous for the Russian economy. It's disastrous for Ukraine. But yes, that's accurate. Russia does feel encircled. Most Russians who support the war effort, which is to say most Russians, believe that they're resisting American hegemony over the world.
Ambassador McFaul, our caller suggests this is legitimate concern on Russia's part. Maybe back off, give it some breathing room, and it works itself out.
No. two things that are really important to say here. First of all, this is a perception of the United States that did not exist just 3 years ago. Go look up the data. 3 years ago, Russians, two-thirds of Russians thought they had a good relationship with the United States. And President Medvedev, in his last meeting with President Obama, I was there in March of 2012 when they met in South Korea, said, U.S.-Russian relations have never been better ever in the history of U.S.-Russian relations. That's the leader of the Kremlin just 3 years ago. So to say that this is the result of, you know, NATO expansion coming up on their borders, us wanting World War III, I disagree with. And two more things I would say about history. Go back and look at what President Obama said in July of 2009 when he gave his major speech while visiting Moscow. He said, it is in the American national interest to have a strong, prosperous Russia. That's the president of the United States. First time in history any president has said that. That's not Cold War rhetoric. That's not we need World War III to exploit Ukrainian oil and resources. That's the president saying there's a different way to have a relationship between the United States and Russia. I was at every meeting between Putin and Medvedev except one in the 5 years I was in government. Mm. Not once did the issue of NATO expansion come up because it was not an issue at all in terms of the substance of what either Putin or Medvedev were bringing up. It's all been invented as a result of this crisis.
Invented because of what you were saying earlier, that Putin doesn't feel solid in his position as Russian leader?
Correct. Putin needs an enemy to maintain his legitimacy. And by the way, in the short term, it's worked. He was at 43-45% for a year and a half in terms of popularity. He's now up at 80%. I would just underscore, however, something very important that I thought Masha said before the break. This is a pattern you see always when countries are under siege. President Bush had 90% approval rating for the war in Afghanistan at the beginning, and he had 75% of the American people supporting him when he went into Iraq. Those numbers can change. And that, by the way, was without controlling the media and without having a Congress that was completely supportive of him, like Putin has. Those numbers can change over time as people begin to wonder, why are we in those places? And I think over time, Russians will begin to wonder, what are we doing in eastern Ukraine? These are our friends. These are our neighbors. These are people we've lived with peacefully for a long, long time. What is this doing in terms of Russia's long-term national interests?
Andrew in New Orleans and Louisiana. Andrew, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Yes. My wife is from southern Ukraine. We have family that lives in southern Ukraine. And, you know, they left Russia to get away from everything that Russia was when the Soviet Union fell. They wanted nothing to be a part of it. Now they're getting thrown back into the middle of this. And, you know, the city that they live in, nobody wants this. It's an unwelcomed invasion into their land. And we spend so much time talking about Russia, and we lose sight of the people that are stuck in the middle of this that can't defend themselves, you know, and there's so many young boys that are just getting thrown into this that shouldn't be in. We're afraid my brother-in-law is going to be drafted, you know,
into Ukraine's military to fight over these separatist incursions.
You know, all of this is to for what? And to start a war with the West, as everyone's been saying. You know, the Ukrainians aren't looking at that way. And I just don't, you know, I haven't heard any of your guests talking about actually benefiting Ukraine.
I mean, Ukraine's got a tough hand geographically. There's no question about that. And right now, I would have the same fear if it was my nephews there. Andrew, I appreciate your call from New Orleans. One more from Montreal, Canada. Daniel, you're on the air.
I think that it is very regrettable you've got two people discussing this from basically the same side of the issue. It might have been much more illuminating for your guest if you'd had somebody speaking, representing the Russian concerns as they see it. I'd like to point out just a few facts and then got off and let other people talk.
Yep.
For one thing, Eastern Ukraine has long been a center for the production of electronic system for the Russian military.
Right, military tech, yep.
The loss of that area and will involve a massive setback militarily for the Soviet Union. The Crimea is a vital base, in their view, for access to the Mediterranean, and the loss of that would be unacceptable in the same way that, for example, loss of access to the Panama Canal would be seen as unacceptable for the United States. I think that it is regrettable that the Western analysis of this issue refuses to see the vital interests of Russia as a serious fact. The United States has repeatedly invaded countries that it believed it had to for its vital interests. It would not tolerate, but Cuba's the classic example. It would not tolerate a pro-Soviet government close to its border.
Well, of course, it ultimately did, and for a long time.
Yes, and now what we have, basically, your ambassador associate there has said that it's simply a fabrication, the concern about NATO drift. In fact, Gorbachev was given assurances there would be no NATO expansion. The expansion has occurred. Missile systems are being set up very close to the Russian border, which cuts down on the response time in the case of an American missile attack. It is American policy to use first-strike nuclear attack in some situations. So the Russians are naturally getting very nervous. Your earlier caller who spoke about the invasion of Russia could have mentioned that there have been three invasions of Russia from the West over time. Napoleon, there was the post-revolutionary invasion.
Yeah, after Daniel, I've got it. I want to put that to Michael McFaul. Michael McFaul, please take it with the seriousness that Daniel does from Montreal. Here's a military technology center, very important to Russia. Here's naval access in Crimea. Here is a history. And here is NATO closer to Moscow than perhaps Gorbachev would have imagined. What do you say?
So lots of things to try to respond to. I mean, your caller is right that Russia has security interests the way they perceive them vis-a-vis Ukraine. Most certainly in Crimea because of the naval base there, and most certainly because eastern Ukraine has many companies, not just the military, integrated with the Russian economy. I agree. The question is, how can Russia legitimately pursue those interests? And I would just say two things. I think they are just, if I were an advisor to Putin, like, you know, what's our best way to make sure that we integrate those industries in eastern Ukraine to be part of us? It's not through supporting separatists. That to me is a way that will undermine that economic relationship.
Why not? You don't think Russia has the strength to go in there, take it, and hold it? through separatists,
maybe,
if you
maybe
like?
They do, but that's such a 19th century way to think about the way the world economy works. I mean, yeah. I live here in the Silicon Valley. We have, the biggest immigrant populations here are from India and Russia and China. Does Russia, India, or China need to invade the Silicon Valley to have that trade and that interaction? It's just, it's such an old-fashioned way to think about the economy. That's an imperial way to think about it. It doesn't work that way. Trade for the last 20 years between Ukraine and Russia was doing just fine without this intervention. But I want to get actually to your earlier mm-hmm. caller. I think his name was Andrew, mm-hmm. which is
in New Orleans,
really,
with family in Ukraine.
Yes. I mean, that is really the essence of what is, in my view, so tragic about this. None of this was necessary. The people of eastern Ukraine and southern Ukraine and all of Ukraine, they didn't ask for this. They didn't ask to be liberated. Opinion polls in those places show very clearly that a majority want to be part of Ukraine. And so what this means is it's just a needless waste of both young boys that are fighting and also civilian casualties that are dying as a result of this war on both sides. It's all so unnecessary. There are better ways for countries to achieve their national interest than this. And the last thing I want to say is when somebody says, well, Russia invaded there because we invaded Cuba, well, two wrongs don't make a right. If you think it was wrong for us to support the insurgents in Cuba and the Bay of Pigs back then you can't cite that as a justification for what Putin's doing today.
Marshall Gessen, cover of Time magazine, and again, I feel like I'm back in 19, I don't know what, 70-something here. Blood red cover.
More like 1870s.
Yeah. Cold War II. And it's got Vladimir Putin against this red cover with a long shadow of the Malaysian downed airliner behind him. And it says the West is losing Putin's dangerous game. Now, you say it's more than Cold War, but what about the West is losing? What do you say, Masha?
Well, the West is playing catch up. And, you know, when we talk about sanctions, the sanctions are, I feel, even though, as I said, you know, the obviously the steps are getting stronger and we're seeing a lot more unity in Europe than we ever saw before, but it's still catch up. Putin still has the upper hand. Putin still has the initiative. And the West is basically responding to what Putin does and is then waiting to see what Putin does next in responding to that. That, unfortunately, is the way that an authoritarian regime interacts with a democracy always, because the authoritarian regime acts faster. The democracy has deliberative ways and has procedures and is generally always stuck playing catch up. That's part of the problem. But the other part of the problem is a basic misunderstanding of what's going on in Russia. And this basic fallacy that Putin can be influenced, which he cannot.
Chuck in Iowa City, Iowa. Chuck, you're on the air.
Hello, Ms. Gessen. I wondered, as a Russian citizen who has had specific threats against your life made by police officials, why did you return? And don't you fear for your own safety and your family's safety?
I live in New York, and the reason I live in New York is because I feared for my family's safety. I go back to report and will continue to go back to report as long as I'm able to get in and out, because that's what I do. That's my job.
There you go, Chuck. That's a straightforward and brave answer, I'd say. Ambassador McFaul, how do we get out of this? You must feel, being back here in the States, and I think Masha's right, Americans are not up for this. Many don't want this. You hear that today. And who can blame them? The Cold War was no fun. And who wants to get back into it? I think many people look at this and still see it as a kind of kabuki, a kind of pantomime, not the real deal, and don't want to interpret it that way.
Well, you hear it in the president's own remarks. President Obama's remarks. Nobody wants a Cold War. Most certainly the administration doesn't. But that doesn't mean you can't respond, that
so,
you can
so
avoid
what's the response that's effective but doesn't get us into something needless, expensive, costly, all the rest?
Well, I actually think the response so far has been the right response. Nobody's talking about sending American soldiers to Ukraine. That's not on the table at all. Nobody wants a hot war.
We're talking about potentially, front page of the New York Times says Pentagon wants to help Ukraine target Russian weapons. That sounds pretty close to hot.
Well, to get back to the debate about how this will end, The sanctions feedback effect will be long and measured in years. I totally agree with what Masha said, that when Putin sees these new sanctions, his reaction is not, oh, my goodness, I got to change my strategy now because they put these new sanctions. That will only happen after the economy weakens, after the elites mobilize. And I measure that in years, not weeks or months. The truth is that Ukraine, the government in Kyiv, is the internationally recognized government, including by Russia, and they have a right to try to maintain security in their borders. And that probably is the fastest way that this crisis will end, when Ukraine reasserts its sovereignty over all of its territory.
No sign of that shaping up crisply anytime very soon. Ambassador Michael McFaul, U.S. Ambassador to Russia until just earlier this year. Thank you for joining us today, sir.
Thank you.
Masha Gessen, Russian-American journalist, author of The Man Without a Face, and she's talking Vladimir Putin. Masha, thanks as always for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
On Point is produced by Nick Anderson, Catherine Brewer, Julie Jopp, Sam Gail Rosen, Eileen Imada, Stefano Katsonis, Sarah Platt, James Ross, and Dean Russell. With help from Abigail Collins, Gretel Kaufman, and Sarah Wanger, our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. Thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.